Pass the Mic is made possible by a grant from the T. Rowe Price Foundation, recognizing 45 years of advancing thriving communities and building financial well-being. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the participants and do not reflect the views of the T. Rowe Price Foundation, T. Rowe Price, or any of their subsidiaries or affiliates.
Pass the mic.
Hand that to me.
Pass it over here.
Pass the mic.
Can you hear me?
Oh, nice.
Where's the microphone? Oh, oops. I need to be right here, don't I? Hold on.
Hello, I'm Simone Phillips, creator of Charm City Table, and you're listening to Pass the Mic. It's the show where every episode features a different host, someone from the community who leads a conversation on issues that matter to them. I am honored to be the host for this episode. Today, we're talking about the Baltimore food scene, its history, and the people behind it.
You know, at 7 years old, my dad would bring oysters home and he would shuck them over the counter in the sink.
The best blue crabs in the country only come from Maryland and Virginia waters.
The travels through that African Atlantic is key to all the food ways and what wound up coming here. You'd be surprised at how much that has impacted the food across this country.
But first, a little bit about me. I'm from Baltimore, born and raised. And what began as a hobby to capture the decadent dishes and interesting cocktails at local restaurants and food festivals, that has evolved into an award-winning platform that I call Charm City Table.
Hey foodies, my name is Simone and I'm the creator of Charm City Table, a new Korean barbecue spot recently opened up in Columbia, Maryland. I love strolling around a farmer's market on the weekends, and Baltimore City has a new one in the Hollins Market neighborhood.
Now, that's my full-time career, and I'm dedicated to highlighting Baltimore in a positive light, along with the people who feed the city's soul. Today, my guests are true trailblazers who have helped redefine what a Baltimore staple looks like. I'm pleased to welcome Jasmine Norton. Welcome, Jasmine.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Doing good. I'm feeling great. Happy to be here.
She's a Baltimore native, executive chef, and visionary behind the Urban Oyster, the first Black and women-owned oyster bar in the country.
That way, turn it one more time, like the unlocking of the door. That way you can see in it more. You see?
Honestly, I've been trying to figure out how we can, I don't know, be in some sort of Guinness book about it, but I did my research, right? And being an avid oyster lover myself, I've been to research every single oyster bar you can think of. There really wasn't a space that existed, you know, in that particular specific way. It's very male-dominated, very white male-dominated, you know, eating oysters, all that stuff. But when you go through the history, and the oystermen, a great deal of them who harvested, they were Black
That's
men.
Right.
Going back as far as Thomas Downing, you know, he was the first Black man to open an oyster bar in New York, in Brooklyn, and he was from Chincoteague, Virginia. So a lot of what you see in our existing restaurant comes from inspiration of how it was always described his oyster cellar would look like.
Wow. That's really interesting. I love, you know, that's why I thought of you for this episode, because I feel like you're not just doing the cooking. You're looking into the history, you're doing your research, and it's just so interesting to hear how it's all connected to your identity, to Maryland specifically. So it just all feels very full circle.
Absolutely.
So you started at 19 cooking, and then you started your business at 29.
Yes.
Why oysters? Why was that like the focal point?
You know, I grew up eating oysters as a child. You know, at 7 years old, my dad would bring oysters home and he would shuck them over the counter in the sink and douse them with hot sauce and lemon. I was a big foodie. I would always go out to eat and go to different places. And I started cooking just in general from going to college. I no longer had my mom, you know, to cook me food and cook me dinner. And so I had to learn at 19 how to cook. And I would hold her on the phone for hours. And honestly, by just simply learning to nourish myself and care for myself, I found a love for it. So I started the business in 2017, and at the time when I started not enjoying my original career in audiovisual, I wanted to pivot, and I learned that I had a fibroid like the size of a grapefruit. And, you know, my bosses and my VP, they never checked to, like, ask me how I was doing, but when I was coming back, and I was just, like, flabbergasted.
Yeah.
And I was just like, this is insane. Like, I literally had to have what's equivalent to a cesarean to have that fibroid removed. And in that recovery is when I was really putting the puzzle pieces together for Urban Oyster. And I saw my life flash before my eyes. I had never imagined even going through that at, 29 years old? Because I had to build my body up just to even have the surgery. And I was in a cancer institute having iron infusions just to get my body strong enough to have surgery. And I was like, there's no time, you know, better than now to, like, chase my dreams and do in my own versus someone else's. I started the business with my family and friends, and I paid them in oysters and all that stuff. We started doing our very first event. I don't know if you remember, back in Towson, there was that place called Truffle Butter Bistro.
I do remember.
That was the very first event we did. That was my very first event from recovery. You know, we just started doing every single festival in the city, you know. Artscape,
yes,
Airframe.
Everywhere. I feel like I see you at every major festival.
I don't think anybody understands, like, the sweat equity in the history that we as a Black culture have in oyster farming and the waterways and things like that. And I was just like, I wanted our people and people in general to just have an appreciation for that species. You know, if I would go out with my group of friends, they never wanted to go to an oyster bar. And I'm like, what's the issue here? And they're like, oh, they look nasty, they're ugly, they're raw, they're slimy. When I started to, you know, think about me wanting to start the business, I wanted it to be oysters, right?
Yeah. I feel like that's such a huge part of your brand, too. When I think of people who look like us, you know, Black people, when they're like, oh, I don't know if I like oysters or I've never had them, I'm like, right. I know exactly where to take you. It's either the farmer's market or to your actual restaurant.
Absolutely.
Well, you were building incredible momentum when the world came to a halt in 2020. How did the COVID-19 pandemic change your perspective on what your brand or what a restaurant needs to be?
Yeah, I mean, diamonds are developed out of pressure, right? And,
yeah.
And that's exactly what it was for me. To be honest, the location that we were in, even before the pandemic started, it was not a good location for us. It was just off the beaten path. And I was angry about having to lose and leave that location. But after a while, I've learned that it was a blessing in disguise, honestly. And so I just needed to say it out loud, right?
Yeah.
I just needed to be honest and put it out there, like, hey, we're leaving and we're losing this place. And talk about community, right? I mean, everybody was on my line. Like, what can I do? How we can't see Urban Oyster leave and lose and all of that stuff. We can't lose Urban Oyster. And so, you know, shout out to my brother Jason Bass and Dante Johnson when they used to run the Revival.
I remember, yeah.
You know, they opened their home to me and allowed us to stabilize and continue to go on. So
yeah, I was one of those customers still down at Hotel Revival.
Listen, you're a day one,
yeah,
Simone.
Yeah, I remember. I had recently moved to the Remington neighborhood and you had like a pop-up there shucking raw oysters.
Yeah.
And that was like the first time I ever knew the Urban Oyster existed. I've been a fan ever since.
It has been cold. Now here we are talking about temperatures, 5, almost 10 degrees below average.
The prolonged sub-freezing temperatures have left much of the Chesapeake Bay iced over and is part of the reason for the collapse of this year's oyster season.
This year, we had one of the coldest winters Baltimore has experienced in decades. Parts of the Chesapeake Bay froze over, and oyster farmers and watermen have been struggling because they can't harvest oysters in ice. How were you impacted by the cold this season, if at all?
Yeah, so it wasn't tremendous. I mean, we have some amazing farmers and, you know, people who nurture and take care of the waterways. I will say it, for us, it was more so like going in that further northern region. Quality is of top priority for us. So we had to make some pivots and either stop serving them or get something from somewhere else. So, yeah.
Yeah. Now, you've gotten a lot of recognition for your work. I've seen you in Best of Baltimore often. Last year, you had a James Beard nod for Best Chef in the Mid-Atlantic, which is one of the most coveted awards in the restaurant industry. What do awards like that mean to you?
You know, it is still to this day extremely surreal to be nominated for Best Chef in Mid-Atlantic by James Beard is insane. I mean, I'm self-taught. I didn't go or attend anyone's culinary school. And to take it even a step further, everything I learned being a chef and working in this space of food has been in my own kitchen. I've never worked in any other restaurant. I've never worked for any other chef. So it's surreal, like being Best New Restaurant in Baltimore Magazine last year. I'm grateful to be recognized even without all of the classical training and things like that. It's just confirmation that, like, I'm clearly on the right track.
Yes.
And I credit, you know, the Most High for giving me the tools and the skills and the focus and the discipline to get recognition on such high levels.
That's right. Yeah. So what's next for you, Chef Jasmine?
Yeah. What's next? Man, what's not next? I think it's time for us to branch out and go into some other states. You know, Baltimore will always be flagship, will always be home. But we've got our eye on Atlanta right now. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're expanding.
Yes, yes,
we
yes.
We love to see it. The world's eating urban oyster, eating char grilled, eating raw oysters.
Indeed.
And keeping Baltimore home. We love it. Well, thank you, Jasmine. Thanks
thank
for coming
you.
On and having this conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Jasmine Norton is the owner and executive chef of The Urban Oyster. You can get a taste for what all the hype is about by visiting The Urban Oyster, located in the Hamden neighborhood. You're listening to Pass the Mic. I'm Simone Phillips, founder of Charm City Table, and your host for today's episode. Stay with us.
You're listening to Pass the Mic on 88.1 WYPR. Want to be part of the conversation? Suggest a guest host for Pass the Mic by writing to us at ptm@bemorepublicmedia.org. You can listen to more episodes of Pass the Mic at our website, wypr.org, or wherever you get podcasts. Baltimore Public Media, community amplified.
Welcome back. You're listening to Pass the Mic. I'm Simone Phillips, your host for today's conversation about the incomparable dining scene in Baltimore, Maryland. I'm the creator of Charm City Table, an online platform that's both a food blog and a guide to making thoughtful choices when dining out. I've spent the last several years exploring how food acts as a bridge between our past and our future. Through that work, I've witnessed the incredible evolution of Baltimore's palate. And few people have had more influence than my next guest.
We're storytellers, and it's important for us to acknowledge the fact that the people that came before us did not have a chance to speak.
Chefs Tanya and David Thomas are the forces behind Baltimore-based Heirloom Food Group. You might know them from their once-beloved establishment, Ida B's Table, or more recently, their work with Outstanding in the Field, a roving restaurant that turns the act of dining into storytelling.
Through these stories and through food, we're able to educate the next generation and help them understand.
Whatever their project, they're not just cooking food, they're preserving heritage. Tanya and David, welcome to Pass the Mic.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Many people know you from your previous establishments, like Urban Soul back in the day, and Ida B's Table.
Yeah.
Those spaces were beloved anchors. When the pandemic hit, it forced the entire industry to rethink its footprint. Did that period of collective stillness provide the seeds for what Heirloom Food Group is today?
I mean, I would say yes. I think we want to make sure we clarify, too, that we left Ida B's before the pandemic. So it wasn't as much of a surprise for us, I guess, as it was for a lot of people. When it happened, we were in Senegal. We just got back into the country the day before they shut down all the airports nationwide. But my intention was to go back in and help them with the transition and get another chef and get it running. And once the pandemic hit, there was no need for that. So I think everybody collectively, took that time to say, okay, what's next? And really it came down to we really wanted to make an impact. How can we do what we do and really help people and tell the stories that we want to tell and create this legacy with the projects that we work on?
Ultimately, you all were doing a bunch of things and then Heirloom Food Group came along.
Yeah.
So what was kind of the inspiration for such a platform that does a multitude of things?
We're doing multiple things, but at the same time, we knew we were going to establish some type of business. We didn't know what. But we basically decided to go back to where we started when we first stepped into the industry, which was catering. So that's the irony. That meant no one was coming out. No one's going to do these big events. Everybody's had to stay at home. So what are we going to do? And I remember the first thing we realized, because we didn't realize how long COVID was going to last.
Yeah.
And the next thing we knew, it came around to the holiday time that year. And we say, well, a lot of people can't go to families. They can't get meals. Some people don't know how to cook. And they're so used to going to other family members that did the Thanksgiving meals for them. And we said, oh, we can sell Thanksgiving meals and people can pick it up and take it home. And that's how everything started with Erlen, literally in 2020. And eventually it got to the point where things started gradually open up. And that's when we had our first dining experience, which was in May of 2021.
And I think between the time, too, we started our product line with the first hot sauce.
And this was just the perfect time to start establishing those streams, to the point that once everything opened up, now you got all your streams already up and running.
I keep up with everything you all have done since I've jumped on the food scene. But I remember when Erlen was first kind of launching and people were starting to hear about it, you had those pickup options mm-hmm. during COVID. And I think it was a lamb sandwich that I used to.
Oh, the lamb dibby.
Oh, the lamb dibby.
Yes, the lamb dibby. Yeah. It was so good. I remember picking that up a couple of times.
That was us bringing back out travels from Senegal.
Yeah. Really?
Right there, so, yep.
We, oh, wow.
He said, we got to do a lamb dibby. And that was it.
It was incredible. Yeah. I still think about that.
Oh, bless you.
Quite often.
We might be bringing it back in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, please. I'll be the first in line.
We always get asked, how can I get your food on a regular basis? Or they always say, you don't have a restaurant? And I'm like, no, we don't. So just being able to come up with something on a monthly basis that people could come to us, that's why we chose to, we got to create something.
Yeah.
The long table was one that we wanted to do where everybody had access. So, you know, the long table being that coursed out, family style, communal, one long table with everybody sitting together. And it's almost like, you know, we're doing this as STEM and Vine. We love the environment there. And we feel like it's like everyone is coming into our home and we're welcoming you there. We get to have stories told and talk about the food, and people get to tell their own stories and what they get from the food that they just had. The Afukaseki passion project for David, something like he said he's been thinking about for years. No more than 15 people, 10-course tasting menu. It's taking the concept of Japanese kaseki dining and merging it with the diaspora.
Wow.
And being able to do that flow of that dining through those 10 courses, bringing out, you know, techniques and seasonality and, you know, methods and, you know, different foods, and being able to tell the story in that way and people being immersed in the food itself without too much taken away from it around them.
Our people have touched every continent on this globe, and Japan is not, you know, foreign to that. So understanding that our people were there early in the early 13th century and understanding what we did in that climate, and then you find out about kaiseki and the reverence that they pay for the food and the seasonality. That's what our folk have been doing from the beginning.
I need to be a part of that. I need to know all about that. That sounds right up my alley. Now, you all have managed to balance a high-profile marriage, you know, and a high-pressure partnership. Who is the one that says we need to take a chance on a new idea?
You mean, who gets to make the final decision?
Who gets to make the final decision?
Oh, okay. Well, you're looking at her. She gets to make the final decision. I mean, listen, we've been married for 34 years.
Wow.
Yeah. So we don't do anything without each other, basically. But, I mean, we both, you know, we're both creatives. You know, so she'll come up with an idea, she'll toss it around, I'll come up with an idea, we'll toss it around. And then, like I said, ultimately she'll make the decision that this is what we're going to do.
But it's got to be where we're both invested in it, because that's the only way it's going to work.
Well, it does sound like it's a collaborative thing, a back and forth, but it sounds like we have maybe a boss on the side of the table.
He always says that. That's him saying that. Understand. That's the story that he likes to give everybody, because his line is always happy wife, happy life.
I stand by it.
Well, let's talk to Chef Tanya, the boss specifically. You recently worked on some projects or a project that treat Black culinary history as fine art. Could you talk a little bit about that and why it's vital, especially right now?
Mm-hmm. I think Maloma's probably
the biggest one that we're doing.
Yeah.
So the project that we have in South Carolina.
Yes.
Maloma Heritage is down in South Carolina on St. Helena Island, something we started back in 2020 where we acquired 38 acres of land collectively between six of us. Out of that, we decided to build Maloma Heritage, which is going to be a space, a farm, a structure, three different kitchens where anyone can come and learn of the foodways. We actually are launching our first Feast and Fields program, and it's where it's going to be a six-day, 10 students. They actually learn about foodways. They learn about indigenous crops. They actually will go on a farm and actually harvest. They actually get cooking demonstrations. And throughout the week, it's different things, whether going on tour around the city, learning about the culture and history there. And it ends on the last day with a community dinner that the students will actually prepare. And this particular one, the first one, is actually being led. Not only we will be there, but also Michael Twitty is going to be the one that's actually going to be conducting the lectures. That is definitely a passion project. Well, we always talk about, you know, those that were enslaved came to this country from West Africa, but it's so much more than that, because the travels through that African Atlantic is key to all the foodways and what wound up coming here and what we see all over this country, whether you're here in the Mid-Atlantic, here in Maryland itself, or when you go down south to South Carolina, the Gullah Geechee Corridor, or anywhere when you go to the Midwest, you'd be surprised at how much that has impacted the food across this country. And then when people migrated, how it then influenced the food once again. It actually initially started because there was land being taken from a lot of people there doing tax lien sales. And initially we went down there to say, how can we go help them not lose their land? And when I'm saying that, I'm saying black landowners that were losing their land. And in the process, we wound up coming up with this whole project. Everyone initially with Michael Twitty, Chef BJ Dennis is involved, David and myself, Adrian Lipscomb, Mashama Bailey is a part of this.
Menus, recipes.
Seeds.
And that's a separate part of the archive, but an important part of the archive, the seed storage. Mm-hmm. But then just the archaeological facts, whether it's cast iron skillets, tools and cast iron things from the early 1800s that were used by African-American cooks. So I'm excited about all kinds of stuff, but the live fire cooking and mm-hmm. being able to talk to students about our history and mm-hmm. educate them on, you know, our food ways and the importance of having pride in the work that we do.
I'm really excited for that. I knew a little bit about it, but I didn't know the full details. That's incredible. That's one of the many things that inspires me about you both. It's not just black food, which is amazing in and of itself, but, you know, you all use it to create this, like, historical record and this archive and to show people the history. And that's what always keeps drawing me back to your story and, you know, who you are as people and chefs and the work that you do.
And that means, Chef David Thomas, you are the Chopped champion.
Chef David, you've stood on the national stage as a Chopped champion. What is one chapter of your story or the black food story or Maryland's food history that you feel is maybe being overlooked by the mainstream?
Wow. Yeah, I think probably the biggest thing is just the contributions of our people. Our stories wouldn't be told if we didn't tell them. And we talk about this all the time, Colbert and Jewett, and how they are important to the Maryland food history and broader to the United States and the world's history. Colbert and Jewett founded one of the oldest seafood packing companies in the country. 1910, I believe it was.
I still have that T-shirt from you all.
Okay. St. Michael's Island. Well, Frederick Jewett mm-hmm. Was one of the partners. He came up with the crab grading system. So whether you call it back fin or special or lump or jumbo lump or colossal, those terms were coined and created by him in his crab processing plant. Nobody knows that story. Nobody knows that, you know, this prize thing that we've, you know, decided to separate into different categories was created by this black man. And I hate the fact that we have to use the term black food and black stories, but our stories wouldn't be told if we didn't tell them.
When you're just at the store, you're just trying to get your lump or your jumbo bottle. Right. But that's, you know, that's such an important story, and it gives you such a sense of pride when you're born, you come out the womb, you automatically have an identity. Mm-hmm. And a lot of our identity, you know, Baltimore is 60%+ Black. Mm-hmm. And it's important for us to know those stories and know that that's part of our history and our heritage. And mm-hmm. it's important for people, not just Black people to know, but for everybody to know.
Absolutely.
To understand and to celebrate.
I don't think you have to be Black to be proud about the history.
No.
And that's what we would like people to, you know, to feel. It's like, listen, just because a Black man, you know, created this system, it doesn't mean that white Americans shouldn't be proud of, you know, his legacy.
Yeah. Maryland's history.
It's Maryland history. And mm-hmm. it's Maryland's gift to the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. Blue crabs are one of those things that you can only find in this state, meaning the best blue crabs in the country only come from Maryland and Maryland and Virginia waters. We know that that's important, and we stand on that, and we want people to know that. We should be proud when we tell these stories about our ancestors and how they've contributed to what we do.
Chefs Tanya and David Thomas are the founders and executive chefs of Heirloom Food Group, and Jasmine Norton is the executive chef and owner of the Urban Oyster. You've been listening to Pass the Mic, Baltimore Public Media's community-driven radio program. I'm Simone Phillips. Thanks for listening.
Pass the Mic is produced by Elizabeth Nonamaker, senior producer Mallory Pinkard-Pierre, and executive producer Amy Walters. Theme music and production assistance from Rob Tim. This is a presentation of Baltimore Public Media.